The opinions expressed in this program reflect only those of the participants and are not necessarily those of the sponsors, management, or staff of WTBQ Radio or FST Broadcasting Corporation. WTBQ.
Good morning. Welcome to Health Matters. I'm Robert Patella, Director of Operations and Support Services.
And I'm Christopher Metz, Marketing and Communications Manager with the Bon Secours Charity Health System.
Today's show dives into two vital aspects of stroke care, the urgent life-saving action in the moment of stroke and the journey of recovery and prevention that follows. We're joined by two expert neurologists from the Bon Secours Charity Health System who work every day to save lives and restore hope. First, we're honored to welcome Dr. Mille Etienne, Chief of Neurology and Stroke Medical Director at Bon Secours Charity Health System. Dr. Etienne is also an epilepsy specialist and a nationally recognized leader in neurological care. Dr. Etienne, thank you for being here this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yep, absolutely. So to start off, we like to give our listeners a taste of who we're interviewing for the day. So do you have anything to share with us about, you know, where you grew up or any hobbies or special interests?
Sure. So, yeah, I grew up right here in the Hudson Valley. I grew up in Rockland County, went to the East Ramapo schools, left for a while for, you know, college, medical school, went on active duty in the Navy for some time, have served over 20 years, and I'm back here working in Rockland County.
Welcome back. We're very happy you're here. So what inspired you to pursue medicine? Was there a calling in particular or any particular event that sparked the desire?
Yeah, definitely growing up, I, you know, just going through my various classes in, you know, elementary, middle school, high school, I was always drawn to the brain. I was really interested in getting to understand the brain better. And I started being, you know, seeing what area could I actually go into where I could actually be focused on the brain. And so there were different ways to do it. And I found that doing it through medicine would be the best route for me.
Okay. Excellent. So we're talking today about stroke. Could you just define for the listeners what exactly is a stroke and why early recognition is critical?
Yes, absolutely. So stroke typically means the most common type of stroke we think about is when a blood vessel has a clot in it. So just remember, blood vessels, their job is to deliver blood to different parts of the body. And the blood it's delivering is blood that has oxygen in it. So the real thing it's bringing is oxygen to all the parts of the body, and that oxygen is what's needed for your cells to survive. So when somebody has a stroke, that blood vessel is blocked off, which means that that vessel can no longer deliver blood and oxygen to a part of the body. When that happens in the brain, we call that a stroke, which means that for every second that blood vessel is blocked off and can't deliver the oxygen, that means brain cells are dying.
So that makes sense as to why we commonly in the marketing world refer to stroke prevention and care than talk about how time is brain. So can you break that? I mean, you kind of broke that down in medical terms, you know, blood reaching your brain and the less that it or the shorter time it takes to get there or the more blockages, the brain doesn't get that oxygen it needs. So that kind of brings to life why time is brain is important. But we also have the acronym BFAST. Could you kind of go through that for our listeners and why BFAST is an easy acronym to remember for spotting a stroke and what the next step should be?
Sure, absolutely. So when we always find that, you know, giving a mnemonic like that makes it easier for people to understand what we're talking about. So we came up with the idea, and it's not really my idea. This is the American Heart Association and the American Stroke Association. They say, remember, be fast, because we want you to, you know, move quickly, right? So the B stands for balance, which means that the person has lost their balance or their coordination feels off. It might even be a severe dizziness that the person is experiencing. The E is for eyes. Are you experiencing a change in vision? Might it be double vision? Are you having trouble seeing a part of the world all of a sudden? These are the vision changes that we might see. F in BFAST stands for face. Do you have a facial droop? Did you notice a facial droop in your friend or your family member? That is oftentimes an indication that a stroke is happening. A is for arms, but also think about the legs. Arms and legs could have weakness in that limb. So whether it's an arm weakness, a leg weakness, oftentimes the two will come together. So don't just think it's going to be the arms. It could be either or both. And then the speech. Are you having difficulty speaking? Is it a slurred speech? Or what we often hear patients say is, I know what I want to say, but I just can't get it out. So any of these abrupt changes in speech should be cause for alarm. And then the T is a reminder that when you experience this, you have to get to the emergency room. And we generally recommend that you call 911 and not try to drive to the emergency room, because really, imagine you start driving and you get caught in a traffic jam or the car breaks down or some other thing happens, and now you're not going to be able to get to the hospital to get that emergency care. So be fast, and really the fastest way you can get to the emergency room is the way to get there, and I say it's the ambulance.
Yeah, that makes sense. And also I can imagine if you're trying to drive yourself and you're potentially having a stroke, you might have complications with just driving in general and then cause maybe an accident that includes other people and prevents your care even further.
Yep.
Absolutely. We have seen that plenty of times. That's not rare, what you've just brought up, that we do see patients trying to drive to the emergency room. Sometimes they can't see let's say, the right half of the world. They've got a big blind spot all of a sudden. Guess what? All of a sudden they're driving on the sidewalk, running over mailboxes, or even hitting someone. But oftentimes they might crash into a tree, crash into a pole. And you know, you're weak. If all of a sudden you have weakness and you're trying to drive, you might not have good control. And keep in mind, even though you might feel like you can drive, that stroke might get worse while you're on the way to the emergency room, and all of a sudden you become incapacitated.
Understood.
So really, 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 we want to get you to that emergency room as quick as possible.
So that makes perfect sense. And I guess the good news on this is that these symptoms, it sounds like there's a number of them, and they're pretty, I would think, significant and obvious symptoms. So maybe it would help in recognizing what you're going through. Is it common to experience only some of these, or are they usually experienced all together as a whole?
Yeah, great question. You do not have to have all of these symptoms. You might just have one of them. It's not typical that anybody would have all of those at the same time. Some people who are having a really bad stroke will have all of these all together, but it might just be one. It might be suddenly you can't see, or suddenly the arm is paralyzed. We try to keep it simple by saying be fast, but sometimes a sign of a stroke might be having the worst headache of your life, severe headache you've never had before. That might be a sign of a stroke. The person becomes confused and unresponsive. That could be a sign of a sign of a stroke. So really, you know, any of these abrupt changes in your status, you got to get to the emergency room.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it also makes sense with be fast, because we're kind of saying, you know, time is brain, be fast. And I'm guessing your outcome is quite high the quicker you can get that care, as opposed to delaying that care. And would you say that, you know, someone who can get that care super quick has a better outcome? Is that true?
Yes. Oftentimes they have much better outcomes if they can get to the emergency room right away. I have seen it where the person, you know, I had a guy once, he was watching a World Series game, and half his body became paralyzed. He says, oh, no, I don't want to. He wanted to finish watching the game. So he sat there, watched the game, then fell asleep, woke up the next morning, he's paralyzed. He missed his window of opportunity.
Right.
If he had come to the ER right away, we could have given him a clot buster medication, And we could have done something else that we call thrombectomy, which means pull the clot out of the brain. We can actually identify that clot early on, and we can pull it out.
So let's get into that after this quick break, Dr. Etienne, and then we'll go right into Care at Good Sam and St. Anthony and Bots, of course. We'll be right back.
St. Anthony Community Hospital in Warwick offers all of Orange County total joint replacement surgery, vascular surgery, the Kennedy Birthing Center, Infusion Center, which is open 7 days a week, and the Sleep Disorder Institute, to name a few. St. Anthony Community Hospital, Shervere Long-Term Care and Rehabilitation Facility are all members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network. Call 845-986-2276.
Hey, I'm TJ.
Hey, I'm J-Bo.
Hasn't it been fun getting all these voicemails?
Yeah, I love it. My favorite part of the show.
When we're not in the studio, you call 302-303-1151. You can leave a message about anything going on in your life, something we talked about on the show, and maybe you'll hear your voice on the next TJ show.
This is Melissa inviting you to join me every Thursday at 12 noon when we open the door to the Curiosity Shop and invite you to explore the world of magic and the paranormal while connecting you with loved ones who have passed. All right here on Radio Worth Listening to.
WTBQ.
Good morning. Welcome back to Health Matters. I'm Robert Patella, Director of Operations, and I'm here with Christopher Metz, Marketing and Communications Manager with the Bon Secours Charity Health System. We've been speaking with Dr. Mill Etienne about recognizing and responding to stroke. Sorry, Dr. Etienne. Last we took a break there. We had to interrupt you. You were speaking on clot buster medications. You want to go ahead and fill us in a little further on that?
Yeah, so one of the things, the way I explain this to my patients when I see them in the emergency room is, you remember what I said earlier, the stroke itself is a blockage in a blood vessel, which we call an artery, inside your brain. Think about blockages you've had in your house. Let's say your sink is blocked, or let's say the sink is probably the easiest example. If your sink is blocked, what do you do? You might take a solution, something like Drano, pour it into the sink, and that might break up that clot, right? And that's what we have a medication called Tenecteplase that we use these days. And that, to me, I say it's very similar. Obviously, it's not toxic like Drano. So you say, okay, the person's coming in. If you come within 4.5 hours, of the last time you were known to be normal, and there's no contraindications, we are going to inject this medication into your veins. And that medicine will dissolve that clot and break it up, which is huge, because it can dissolve the clot, and that could lead to all your symptoms resolving, or sometimes part of your symptoms resolving. If after we put that medication in, we usually do a scan beforehand to look at the clot and we visualize it. And if we see that it's a large blood vessel that's blocked off, after we give you that Tenecteplase, we're going to follow it up with something called thrombectomy. Think about the snake you might use in your sink to throw it in there and yank that clot right out of there. This is very similar. We're going to go into the what we call interventionalists, will go through a vein, usually in your groin. They'll follow it up to the brain at the precise location where that clot is located, and they've got a device that will actually grab the clot and pull it out. So it's a two-step process you can get if you get to the hospital in time. One is the clot buster to dissolve the clot, and two, if that wasn't enough, we're going to pull the clot out with that, doing that, what's called a thrombectomy, clot extraction.
Who are you going to call clot busters? That's what I'm hearing.
Clot busters. Exactly.
That, it's kind of fascinating to me that you mentioned, if we can't proceed with the medication and, we have to go in and get the clot ourselves, but it's through the groin. That's wild to me. So is that, why through the groin?
Yeah, because in the groin, you have a large vein there that is makes it really called the femoral vein. It gives you really easy access, and we have a lot of experience. You know, but actually, what they started doing, this is how they've treated heart attacks. You know, people have a clot inside their heart. They would go through the groin, follow that up to the heart vessels, and start clean. You know, pull that clot out. So we do the exact same thing now with the brain, because it's a really easy access through the groin. Now they're starting to do some of these procedures, transitioning to using the arm. There's a vein in your arm that's even closer to the brain, right? So they use that for the heart, and I expect that will, in the long run, we'll start seeing that more and more potentially for the brain thrombectomies.
And I can imagine the recovery time is much shorter with this kind of procedure.
Oh, yes. I mean, because it's not like you're going to be cutting up your skull or anything. There's no actual brain surgery that you're doing. You're really just going into the blood vessel and pulling that clot out. I've seen people come in, can't talk, half the body's paralyzed. Somebody who, you know, 15, 20 years ago would have been confined to a nursing home the rest of their lives, not able to communicate with their families. I've seen them fully reverse, back to their baseline normal, and back to work within a couple weeks, doing whatever job they used to do. So this is what we call a breakthrough. Huge, huge, huge potential for improvement if you get to the hospital in time.
Yep, that's astounding. And so you're mentioning getting to the hospital. Can we just walk through the process? Once a patient presents to a hospital, to one of our hospitals, and you know, is presenting some stroke symptoms, could you just go over what the care process would look like from them?
Yeah, so you're going to go to the you'll get to the emergency room. Once you get there, usually that's the other benefit, by the way, because you asked this, of using the EMS, using the 911, is that a lot of times 911 team, the paramedics will call the ER before you arrive. And they'll say, we've got somebody on the way who we think is having a stroke. What does that do? That will mobilize the team. So now the ER provider, whether it's a doctor, nurse practitioner, or a PA, will be waiting for you. The CAT scan machine, which we need to scan your brain, we're going to clear it out so that it's ready and waiting for you. The lab team, who has to draw your blood, will be waiting for you. The neurology team, who's going to need to evaluate you, will also get ready to start waiting for you. So now, because of that what we call a pre-notification, that gives them much better care, because now everybody's waiting for you to arrive, almost like you're the guest of honor showing up, and we're all waiting to greet you. Once you get into that ER, and it does look like you're having a stroke, usually the nurse will be notified immediately, and then they'll call overhead. In our hospitals, we call it a brain stat. You've heard the word stat. Stat means emergency. We've got to act fast. So we say this is a brain stat. It gets called overhead. All relevant parties get paged so that they know that this patient is here and needs immediate care. And then immediately you'll get an evaluation where they'll do an examination and determine a score. We have a score that we usually calculate for each patient that helps us to determine the severity of the stroke. And you'll get a CAT scan right away, which is a picture of your brain to make sure you're not bleeding in the brain. Because sometimes this could be a brain bleed, which is another type of stroke that has completely different treatment approach. And so once we confirm that you're having a stroke, your labs look okay, and you don't have anything that tells us that you would potentially bleed from the medication, because the main side effect of that clot buster medication is bleeding. So we want to make sure that you're not at risk for bleeding. And especially if you're on a blood thinner medication, you have to let the doctors know. We're going to ask you. We're going to do everything we can to make sure you're not on blood thinners, because if you are on certain types of blood thinners, you will not be a candidate for this treatment. Then once we determine that you are a good candidate, we'll go over it with you, go over the risks and benefits, and then we will give you that IV treatment. And it's a quick IV injection. It takes about a minute or so, less than a minute, really. you know, boom, immediate injection, and then we start in a lot of cases we see that improvement.
So it sounds like it's important for our listeners to know their medications that they're on, or to have their loved ones know the medications they're on. And also, you know, you've touched on another reason why you should call 911 is because when the EMS shows up, you know, they're trained to recognize a stroke. And like you said, they give you the heads up that we're coming with you for a stroke victim. And now we need to, and that gives you guys time to prepare and accurately get ready for that. Like you said, the kind of like rolling out the red carpet for the EMS team's arrival. So that's another reason why 911 is definitely your friend in this stroke situation.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So for our community members listening today, what are some immediate steps they can take to better be prepared for stroke emergencies?
Well, you just did a great job of summarizing it.
So one
is recognizing those signs. Remember that mnemonic: be fast, balance problem, eye problem, face, arm, speech problems. Call 911. Get to the ER right away. Like you just said there, a very important piece. Bring that medication list with you, because that helps. Because sometimes that is a delay. Say, oh, I'm on a medicine. I don't remember the name. So we don't remember the name. We need to know the name. We need the name of those medications because we don't. We have a tenet in medicine. We say, first, do no harm. If you're on a medicine that makes the medicine dangerous, we don't want to give you medicine and potentially hurt you. So that medication list is critical. Any family members who are around to give the history. Sometimes your stroke is that you can't talk. So we're going to need that family member nearby to be able to give us more history, gathering that data. So those are the really key things for you all to remember.
Yeah, that sounds great. Thank you for sharing that with them.
So, Dr. Etienne, you also specialize in epilepsy. Could you just briefly explain how seizures differ from stroke symptoms and how patients or families could tell the difference between them?
Seizures are an abnormal electrical activity in the brain. And usually when people think of seizures, they often think about somebody, you know, shaking on the ground but there's more to a seizure than that. Sometimes the seizure could just be confusion. It could be trouble speaking, very similar to a stroke. It could be a lot of different things. In fact, people who have had strokes are more likely to have a seizure because any injury you've had to your brain can increase your likelihood of having a seizure in the future. So they are very different. And we treat them completely differently, so it is important to differentiate the two.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, Dr. Etienne, thank you for that powerful insight into how seconds count in stroke care and explaining the difference between epilepsy and stroke. I wasn't aware of those crucial differences. And thanks for, you know, diving into how we deliver fast expert care right here in our community. So can you tell, is there anything else you want to share with our listeners before we end the conversation today? And then can you tell them how to get in touch with you or your team if they have any more questions?
So one thing I'll say, I'm very proud to say that one of the things we've recently done at our three hospitals is instituted a program called Telestroke. And that is actually a program that allows you to get quicker care, so that, let's say, the neurologist is at home. So the neurologist is not available to give you that examination, evaluate you right away. So now we've got Telestroke, which means a neurologist will broadcast right into your room to do the evaluation and make the determination of what treatment you need for that stroke.
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Stay with us, everyone. We'll be right back with Dr. Karp, a vascular neurologist and neurohospitalist at Fonsecours Charity Health System. Thank you again, Dr. Etienne.
Thank you.
St. Anthony Community Hospital in Warwick offers all of Orange County total joint replacement surgery, vascular surgery, the Kennedy Birthing Center, Infusion Center, which is open 7 days a week, and the Sleep Disorder Institute, to name a few. St. Anthony Community Hospital, Shervier Long-Term Care and Rehabilitation Facility are all members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network. Call 845-986-2276.
Hi, this is John Tesh. Tune in for great music and intelligence for your life on weekdays at 1 p.m. as we assemble the tips, the facts, and the news you need to be happier, healthier, more lovable, and more fun to be around. Radio worth listening to.
We put the intelligence out there. You decide what to do with it.
Are you a foodie, a wine connoisseur, or love both? Then join the conversation every Thursday at 11 a.m. with Stephen Keeter and his renowned guests, restaurateurs, chefs, and sommeliers on Food for Thought, right here on Radio Worth Listening to.
WTBQ GHD Weather.
For this morning, a cloudy sky, clouds and rain today. It'll be cool with temperatures only in the upper 40s. Cloudy tonight, rain this evening. Will taper off to shower overnight tonight with lows in the lower 40s. Remains mostly cloudy on Friday with scattered showers, but not an all-day rain. Still on the cool side, though. A little bit better, though, with temperatures in the upper 50s. Showers end Friday night. Maybe some clearing toward daybreak, low in the mid-40s. Partly sunny Saturday. I'm meteorologist Jim Rinaldi.
WTBQ.
Good morning. Welcome back to Health Matters. I'm Robert Patella, Director of Operations and Support Services, and I'm here with Christopher Metz, Marketing and Communications Manager with Bon Secours Charity Health System. For the first half of today's segment, we've been speaking with Dr. Etienne, but we're now joined by Dr. Adam Karp, a vascular neurologist and neurohospitalist at Bon Secours Charity Health System. Dr. Karp works closely with stroke survivors as they begin recovery and focus on long-term health. Dr. Karp, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. So in our last segment, Dr. Etienne started to introduce the idea of telemedicine. Could you elaborate a little bit further on the benefits of telemedicine and its role with stroke?
Absolutely. Telemedicine, and specifically telestroke, as we call it, is a really exciting new addition to the field that we're leveraging more recent technologies to be able to bring acute stroke care a step forward. So one of the challenges that we face in stroke is that not everywhere around the world, or not rather around the area even, do we have access to a 24-hour neurologist who's able to come down to the bedside, see these patients, and and manage these things right away. So what telestroke allows us to do is it allows us to be able to bring that neurologist there. So it's a cart that allows the neurologist to be able to see the patient, speak with them, go through what happened, go through go through the plan and exam with them, and really coordinate the care even if they're not physically present at the bedside. So this is a new thing that's been just slowly becoming more and more common around the country, trying to leverage that access and leverage that technology. So it's really exciting that we now have this capability throughout the system to make sure that every one of our stroke patients, when they come in, the emergency room is seen by a vascular neurologist, by a stroke specialist, right away to make sure that they're getting the absolute best care possible.
That's great, and I'm sure it's crucial for some of these more rural hospital locations.
Absolutely. That's one of the biggest reasons that we try to leverage these things to get get our providers to be able to see people where they are and make sure that they're getting the care they need.
I had the opportunity to see some telemedicine in action. It wasn't an actual patient, but it was the video service that they showed me, and it was quite wild how precise those cameras are and how focused they could see individual little aspects on the patient. It was insane.
It's really impressive. We can actually, on the end that I do some of the telestroke, we can actually zoom in. We can see eye movements really clearly. We can see facial movements. We can get really good audio. We can actually even move what the camera is looking at without even having to wheel the machine around. And so we can even look around the room and to be able to talk to family members and things like that and other people around with the patient to really be part of what's going on and make sure that we are communicating as clearly as possible.
Yeah, that's great. Technology. It's It's quite wild. So, Rob mentioned you're a neurohospitalist, but I'm not sure what that exactly entails. Could you kind of tell us and the listeners what that means, and how does that play a role in care after a stroke?
Absolutely. So by training, I'm a vascular neurologist, which means a stroke specialist, but my main practice is as a neurohospitalist. So what that means is I spend most of my time, almost all my time in the hospital, seeing the sickest of neurology patients, patients who are any neurology patient in the hospital, I'm going to be there to see and treat, and that's what I do all day. So instead of spending the majority of my time out in the clinic seeing people, seeing patients like many neurologists do, I focus on the in-hospital care. So more we call acute or more sudden issues, more pressing issues, emergent life-threatening issues, like stroke, for example. So my care and what I'm mostly involved in is going to be what happens right then when the stroke first happens. And then once we get past that, what the workup is to try to almost go back in time and take out our crystal ball and see what caused that stroke and what we have to do to prevent another stroke from happening down the road. And then being able to help coordinate with the patient and make and discuss lifestyle changes or discuss a rehabilitation or what those next steps are going to look like to get their strength back, to get their function back, and make sure that they're able to return to their everyday life as best as possible.
That's fascinating. And you kind of did go down this road a little bit. But so to your point, after the immediate crisis of the stroke, so can you paint a little bit more detail on how the recovery journey begins for those patients?
So when somebody comes in with a stroke, like Dr. Etienne spoke about, we have a very fine-tuned process to make sure that our patients are getting acute emergent care as quickly as possible. Once we get past that, those kind of quick questions and that quick management, Then we're sitting with a patient who had the potentially significant change to what they're able to do, whether it's movement of one arm, movement of a leg, speech, whatever it might be. And the job becomes, okay, well, why did this happen? And trying to almost play detective and go back through the patient's medical history, go back through, what their risk factors for stroke are. And what can we do to try to prevent another stroke from happening in the future so that we hopefully never end up in this situation again?
Yeah, that makes sense. Prevention, I guess, is key here to kick off that recovery journey. So what could a patient expect or our listeners expect during that recovery process? What would that look like?
Recovery for a stroke is a long process, and it really depends on the patient. We try to make sure everything is as patient-centric as possible, so really looking at what that person's specific needs are and being able to match that. And we work in collaboration with a lot of other team members and a lot of other departments to make that happen. So that includes involving very actively our physical therapists, our rehab specialists, our speech-language pathologists, and making sure that we are able to give them the physical therapy, able to build up that strength, able to give them that rehabilitation. And that can potentially be even months down the road of really intensive therapy to try to get the best recovery we can. And we have plenty of data now that shows that patients who do get that really intense recovery and that interdisciplinary care involving all of these different team members do have better outcomes, and they have a better likelihood of returning back to their everyday life, getting back to work, getting back to their home life, and getting back to things that they were doing before.
Oh, excellent. So you mentioned the rehabilitation process. So why is it so important to start early? Does it make a difference in recovery and outcomes if they start earlier versus, you know, if there's any delay in that process?
It does make a difference. So early physical therapy and intensive physical therapy is the best thing that we have in some of these cases. Once we get past that sudden new emergent management that Dr. Etienne was talking about, like thrombolytic therapies, those things, then it becomes about getting that physical therapy and getting as quickly as possible. We know that the faster somebody starts working on that rehabilitation process, the better they're going to do down the road. And our studies usually look 3 months down the road, but we know that even in those, that the ones who start in those first couple days after a stroke do better than the ones who wait a couple weeks or even months. And their aptitude to be able to recover is better sooner after the stroke.
And what kind of does that entail, that recovery process? I'd imagine they're kind of like working them through acts of daily living. Is it like climbing stairs? Is it getting in and out of cars? That type of thing.
Yeah, and it depends on the patient again, and we try to make it as center to that person as possible. So what are the things that they need to work on? It's mobility training, it's getting in and out of cars, it's different devices that might be helpful in terms of how to do things that they may have trouble doing now, like cooking, cleaning, getting dressed, being able to get around their house. And that really depends on what that person's struggles are and what their needs are to be able to get to the next step.
So it sounds like what someone could expect in our facilities is a highly personalized care structure after the stroke, and what that rehab process would look like, because it's going to be different for everybody if they have speech issues or mobility issues or a combination of many types of issues.
Definitely.
And you mentioned
a
speech pathologist and other people that would help provide care in rehab. What are all those provided through Bon Secours, or how does that work with these other entities that are helping this rehab process?
Yes. So during the inpatient, while somebody's inpatient in the hospital, they'd be seen by all of these different people, by the speech language pathologist, by the physical therapist, by the occupational therapist, to be able to work on what they need. Like you said, this is really about what does this specific person need. There is no one size fits all when it comes to stroke rehab. And that's not the experience we want our patients to have. We want them to be getting what's really geared around what they need and what they're looking for. So they would see all those different people, all those different team members while they're in the hospital. And then from there, once they leave the hospital, we'd be making a plan of, are they going to be following up with physical therapy and with rehabilitation services at home? Are they going to be following up in outpatient settings? Or are they going to be going to an inpatient rehab center? And then we work very closely with our inpatient rehab centers in the area to make sure that they know who our patients are, make sure that they know what their needs are. And we're in constant, I'm personally in constant communication with their providers to make sure that our patients are getting the best care possible.
Okay. Excellent. So to take it a step further, for stroke survivors, after they've, undergone the initial recovery, what does secondary prevention look like, and why is that important?
So that gets back to what caused the stroke. And secondary prevention could look like different things for different people. It depends on what the underlying issue was. Is it what we call small vessel disease, our classic stroke risk factors like blood pressure, diabetes, smoking, cholesterol? Or is it something that the stroke came from somewhere else? For example, it might have come from the heart, or a blood clot can form in the heart and shoot up into the brain. And the treatment and the secondary prevention that we use in those cases is different. And so we have to look at the patient. We've got to look at the individual and understand what their risk factors are and what they need to be able to hopefully prevent this from happening in the future.
So you mentioned risk factors. What are some of the top contributors to stroke that our listeners could take control of right now?
Yeah, so I think one really important note here is that it's estimated in the literature and our studies that about 80% of all strokes are what we call preventable. What that means is that they're caused by some kind of modifiable risk factor that we could actually take control of and change and prevent that stroke from happening. The issue is just knowing that those risk factors are there and taking action about them. And oftentimes it's not easy to do that. But those risk factors, like I said, are things like all of our things that are going to affect our blood vessels in the body, make our blood vessels angry. Blood sugar, so diabetes is a big risk factor. Blood pressure, uncontrolled hypertension. Smoking is a big risk factor. Cholesterol. Those are kind of our major, major risk factors that we look for. Of course, there's other things that we look for as well, but those are our main things that we really try to take control of, and that will not only reduce your risk of stroke, but it will also reduce of heart disease. It will reduce your risk of all sorts of other conditions that come up as we get older.
Okay.
80%, that's quite a big number, too.
Yes, it is.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned diabetes as a risk factor. Could you go into a little bit about what is exactly the connection between diabetes and stroke?
When somebody's blood sugars are out of control, it basically makes the blood vessels not work as well. So the sugar can affect the wall of the blood vessel and make the wall of the blood vessel harder, more rigid, less forgiving as the blood is pumping through. And that causes it to build up what we call plaque or atherosclerosis or cholesterol buildup around the edges of the blood vessel. And eventually that plaque can narrow the blood vessel down to the point where the blood flow can't go as strongly through and an area of the brain can't get blood flow anymore. So we very frequently see strokes in patients who have uncontrolled blood sugars over a long period of time.
So are there any other conditions that might have some sort of connection with stroke? You know, we've mentioned diabetes, but what other ailments might initiate a stroke or have some kind of connection there?
Anything that's going to affect the blood vessels are really over the starting point. So diabetes, blood pressure, high blood pressure is a really crucial one to pay attention to. We often call high blood pressure being almost like the silent killer, that you feel totally fine even if your blood pressure is running high. And that for that reason, many people don't pay too much attention to it. But over time, it causes the blood vessels to become more rigid. It causes them to have more trouble. And eventually, a stroke can happen, a heart attack can happen, and then we have a much more serious issue. We also are concerned about smoking. Smoking also will cause the blood vessels to become more rigid. It causes this plaque to build up quite a bit. And can definitely increase risk of stroke. And there's other things as well. So one of the big ones we talk about is a condition called atrial fibrillation, which is an abnormal heart rhythm that allows for clots to form in the heart and shoot up into the brain. And so that's something that we can use medication to prevent those clots from forming.
That's great. So it sounds like there's a lot of things that can initiate a stroke, but there sounds like there's also a lot of things that people can do to help prevent that. And one of those, like you mentioned, as high blood pressure being the silent killer, having a primary care doctor that, you know, regularly checks your blood pressure is the way to go.
Definitely.
So when we come back, we're going to talk about lifestyle changes, some prevention, and possible rehab. So stay with us.
St. Anthony Community Hospital in Warwick offers all of Orange County total joint replacement surgery, vascular surgery, the Kennedy Birthing Center, Infusion Center, which is open 7 days a week, and the Sleep Disorder Institute, to name a few. St. Anthony Community Hospital, Sevier Long-Term Care and Rehabilitation Facility are all members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network. Call 845-986-2276.
This is your favorite assemblyman, Carl Brabadek, from the mighty 98th District in Orange and Rockland Counties. We're going to be talking about national, state, and local issues every Friday morning at 9:30 on Radio Worth Listening To.
This is attorney Bob Kruhulik of the law firm Beatty & Kruhulik, the lawyer guy. Tune in every Tuesday at 12 noon for the latest legal advice and tips. We're taking calls and giving answers to all your legal questions. That's every Tuesday at 12 noon on Radio Worth Listening To. WTBQ.
Good morning. Welcome back to Health Matters. I'm Robert Patella, Director of Operations and Support Services, and I'm here with Christopher Metz, Marketing and Communications Manager with the Bon Secours Charity Health System. This morning, we've been speaking with Dr. Adam Karp about stroke recovery and prevention. So, Dr. Karp, in our last segment, you mentioned risk factors associated with stroke, such as high blood pressure and diabetes. These are often related to an individual's lifestyle. So can you just go into a little bit about how exactly do we help patients make meaningful lifestyle changes?
Yeah, so lifestyle changes are a really important part in managing all these conditions. The first step in managing any of these conditions is lifestyle changes, and that means diet, exercise, trying to do everything we can to hopefully avoid needing medication assistance. So in terms of exercise, we recommend that every adult gets at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise every week. So that's 150 minutes of walking outside, of trying to get your heart rate up a little bit. There's all different ways that people can do that, and we try to work with our patients and make sure they understand a realistic way that they can accomplish that goal. And that can really help to reduce their risk of diabetes, lower their blood sugars, lower their cholesterol, and really prevent any issues from arising. So diet, typically we recommend the Mediterranean diet is considered to have the best evidence. So that means lots of fresh fish, vegetables, olive oils, things like that that we can eat to try that can also help to lower some of these risk factors and help our blood vessels stay healthy.
From a food perspective, I also partake in the Mediterranean diet, and I highly recommend it because it is quite delicious. So it's healthy and delicious for everyone, so you should all tune in. We talked about some changes, and again, I think it's important to note that all of these like diet and blood pressure are all things that can easily be monitored by a primary care physician and in a yearly wellness checkup. So I think it's just so important for our listeners to make sure that they have a primary care doctor that they speak to about any of these factors that they're seeing or listening to here that they could bring up with their physician and maybe flag something like this so early and prevent it from ever happening or catch it when it's needed. So in addition to like these lifestyle changes, does someone's age, is that also a risk factor? Does that play into someone having a stroke at all?
So as we get older, the risk is higher, and that's considered one of our kind of what we call non-modifiable risk factors, something we can't really do anything about. But if we are able to control all of these other underlying conditions that we do have some control over, we can really decrease that risk. So I try to focus with my patients on the things that we can control, and we know that by doing that, we can really decrease the risk of any issues arising.
Are there any other risk, you know, related demographics that put you at increased risk for stroke aside from age?
There is literature out there on other demographics. Again, these are all kind of non-modifiable things that we can't do something about. So we try to focus on the things that we can control. But other things like drug use aside from alcohol can also have an impact. Certain races are potentially at higher risk, and some of that is thought to be related to diet and things on cultural differences in that regard. So it gets a little complicated and in the weeds of which risk factor of who's potentially at a higher risk. But really, if we can take control of things that we can control and take control of our blood pressure, take control of our blood sugars, make sure these conditions are treated well with collaboration with our primary care physicians, making sure that we're going to the doctor and getting the care we need, we can really prevent or really lower our risk of stroke quite dramatically.
Excellent. Understood. So I've heard of this term. I'm just curious, what is a TIA or a mini stroke, and how serious should this be taken?
So I think it should be taken very seriously. A TIA, or we call it a mini stroke, I would say it's a little bit of a misnomer. The difference between a TIA and a stroke is just that in a TIA, we got lucky and the symptom, and it got better by itself. But the same process underneath happened, the same process of a blood clot forming in the brain or going to the brain and knocking off blood flow to an area of brain still happened. So many TIAs can be high risk and even come with an elevated risk of stroke in the next couple months after it happens. So it should be taken really seriously. And in our health system, especially when somebody has a high-risk TIA, we still admit them into the hospital. We get a full stroke workup on them, and we try to make sure that we're turning over every rock to figure out what our risk factors are and doing everything we can to prevent that full stroke from happening.
So mini-stroke, TIA, full stroke, what other types of strokes are there that are, and how do they differentiate themselves from each other?
So the other type of stroke that's out there, which is a little bit different, is a hemorrhage or a bleed. Many strokes, the strokes we've been talking about, are largely what we call ischemic strokes, meaning that one of the blood vessels got blocked, causing there to be a lack of blood flow to an area. Now, you can have almost the opposite happen, where one of the blood vessels has a tear in the wall and leaks. And in those cases, or bursts, and in those cases, you have a bleed. The most common cause of bleeds is really blood pressure. So we get back to those same risk factors of blood pressure, blood sugar for bleeds as well. But we really want to try and make sure we're controlling those to keep the bleed from getting any worse and to keep anything from happening again.
Okay, understood. So how do you determine, I guess, in their symptoms, in a patient's symptoms, whether someone should go on a blood thinner or some other medication long term?
It depends on what we think caused the stroke. And that's a conversation we have with every patient individually. Was it the standard care is that people go on to antiplatelet medicines like a single aspirin every day. And that's still one of the best medications we have for stroke prevention. But in some cases, it's just not enough. And so if we think that there's something that the stroke came from the heart, for example, we may put them on a blood thinning medication, something like Eliquis or Warfarin or Xarelto to prevent the risk in those cases. But it really depends on what we think caused the stroke and then what medications we need to utilize to and have in our pocket to keep it from happening again in the future.
If someone has had a stroke, could they expect to be on medications for the rest of their life, or would there be a time when they come off them, or is there an instance where they wouldn't go on medication?
Most patients who had a stroke will at the very least be on a single baby aspirin or aspirin 81 milligrams every day for the rest of their life. This is a serious condition, and we don't want to play games with it.
I've heard this baby aspirin before. Should individuals who haven't had a stroke or maybe potentially at risk for a stroke one day be on something like that as a precaution?
So that's a really interesting question. And there's some studies that have tried to look at doing that. And it really depends on the person, it seems. I would say that it's not necessary for everyone across the board, but there probably are some patients out there who have more elevated risk factors who maybe that aspirin could help. And that's something we talk to our patients about and try to decide if that's something that we think could be helpful for them.
Yeah, that makes sense. So looking to the future, are there any new or emerging therapies for stroke prevention that you're watching closely or anything cool that's in development that, that we can expect to see soon?
I think the world of stroke care has changed dramatically in the past even 20 years. I can say that I talk to my medical students about this all the time, but the things that we're talking about today on this radio show are very frequently things that did not exist even 20 years ago. Our thrombolytic therapies did not exist 20 years ago. The one that we're using now, Tenecteplase, it just got its FDA approval in March of this year. Thrombectomy, which I know Dr. Etienne was talking about of going through the blood vessels to try to remove a clot surgically, that did not exist 10 years ago. So the world of stroke has really dramatically changed. Every year at our stroke conferences nationally and internationally, we learn about new things. We learn about new ways that we can push our care for patients. And that's going to really change now with more and more improved technologies, like implementing telestroke. One thing that I think is exciting and we'll hopefully see more of around the area, some urban areas right now. So, for example, in New York City, they actually have stroke-dedicated ambulances that have a CAT scan machine built into them, and you can have the neurologist see the patient, get the CAT scan, and even give medication for a stroke before they get to the hospital, while they're still in the car. So that's something that's out there and being used in certain areas. We have all different rehab programs that are building up using virtual reality and leveraging technology to be able to implement rehab and improve our rehab outcomes. So I think if we talk again in 5-10 years, the things we talk about in all different directions, whether it's stroke ignition, acute stroke care, stroke recovery, is going to be different. And we're going to be having a really different conversation. That's one of the things that makes this field so exciting to be working in.
So tune in for 5 years from now when we open that conversation back up.
Yeah, do you see AI playing any role in stroke and stroke prevention?
It already is in a lot of ways. So one big way that AI is playing a role right now is we actually have AI through the system analyzing our CAT scans so we can get an immediate read, even before the radiologist has time to open the images, which they're doing right away, of course. But when even before they can open it up, we have AI going through, and it can tell us if there's evidence of a bleed, or they can tell us if they think if it thinks there's a blood vessel occluded or blocked off. And so we already kind of implemented in that acute stroke care, and I think we're going to continue to see more and more implementations.
So is the AI implementation similar to kind of like telemedicine? That's how it's kind of being put out there?
So it's a special, it's a separate program that's run over the radiology images. And so the radiology images all go through it, and the AI can read through them and give us feedback and immediate impressions.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Karp, for sharing your expertise on recovery and prevention. And rehab. It's really great to know that there's strong, compassionate teams ready to guide patients, not just through stroke, but beyond it. So is there anything else you would like our listeners to know, or anything you want to leave behind with them, for May as it's Stroke Awareness Month?
I think the biggest thing to leave behind is just the stroke recognition piece, which I know we've mentioned a few times over the course of this, but our BFAST, if you have symptoms of a stroke, come into the hospital right away. So sudden changes in your balance, sudden changes in your vision, sudden facial droop or weakness, sudden weakness of an arm or leg, sudden difficulty speaking, and the T is time. Coming in as fast as possible. The faster you get in, call 911, the more we can do to help you. And we want you to be coming in immediately. So that's really the biggest thing. And the other thing to keep in mind is making sure we control our risk factors and making sure we're getting that preventative care we need. 80% of strokes are preventable. If we're able to work with our primary care providers and be able to get our CR doctors regularly, we can often prevent strokes from happening.
Okay, well, thank you for listening, leaving our listeners with that. Just one note before we wrap up, this will be my last time hosting the segment, but it has been a privilege, it's been a blast, and I've learned a lot from hosting these segments. So continue tuning in to Health Matters, because your health truly does matter. Thanks, Dr. Hart.
Thank you for having me.